Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired CIA officer Ray McGovern, who assesses Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to proceed with a narrow investigation into Bush-era torture policy, conflicting with the mandate of international law for wider accountability. Mike Wishney of the Workers and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School, who explains why little has changed regarding federal raids on undocumented immigrants under the Obama administration. And John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who urges President Obama to acknowledge there will be no bipartisan cooperation on health care reform and to push for a single-payer plan or a strong public option. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The number of killings of gay men in a Baghdad slum known as Sadr City surged in early 2009, the stronghold of Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army. The murders came as gay men had become more open in the traditionally conservative Shiite enclave. At the same time, women have started to discard the abayas, the long black robe that covers a woman from head to foot. Human Rights Watch complains the Iraqi police have taken no action to stop the torture and murder of hundreds of gay men. So far, nobody has been arrested or prosecuted for these atrocities. A top Iraqi police official told the Washington Post, "It is difficult to protect gays because they do not report crimes. Shiite militias often abduct gay men from their homes, torture and later kill them, dumping their bodies on the streets." Many members of the Mahdi army feel homosexuality is a community illness brought to Iraq by American soldiers. Yet, gay life was fairly open under the regime of Saddam Hussein. Grieving by Shiite families for their killed gay sons has put the Mahdi army on the defensive. An al-Sadr spokesperson in May criticized the mass killings of gay men, even though militia fighters continue to target gays. The high U.S. unemployment rate, currently at 9.4%, is driving up the number of home foreclosures, complicating efforts to provide relief to homeowners victimized by the meltdown in subprime mortgages. In the first quarter of 2009, the focus of foreclosures shifted from subprime to prime mortgages. Increasingly, homeowners with good credit ratings lost their jobs and could no longer afford the loan payments. The Washington Post reports 1.8 million homeowners are expected to fall into foreclosure this year, up from 1.4 million in 2008. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, head of the House Financial Services Committee, has proposed using $2 billion from the bank bailout pool for emergency loans to unemployed homeowners. Several economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston have proposed a new program to aid unemployed homeowners. It would lower their payments for 2 years while they looked for new jobs. The program would cost $25 billion to aid 3 million unemployed mortgage borrowers. On the day Walmart announced soaring profits in May, warehouse workers and several priests from Greater Los Angeles briefly stopped traffic at a Walmart distribution center in Fontana, California, a major hub of Asian exports heading to big box retailers. The sit-down protest was the first action in a new union drive to organize Fontana's 100,000 warehouse workers. It was initiated by the Change to Win Union Federation and bankrolled by the Teamsters. The major roadblock to organizing the warehouse workers is the fact they work for 270 different temp agencies. The ultimate goal is creating a single community contract that all the temp agencies would sign on to. Unions have already had success in organizing the truck drivers, mostly independent contractors, who transport the goods to Fontana. But organizing the warehouse workers, who make only slightly more than the minimum wage, is expected to be more difficult, especially with the pro-union Employee Free Choice Act bill hung up in the U.S. Senate. Union organizers are hoping the Obama administration will crack down on permanent temporary workers treated as temps or independent contractors, but who report to the same job site every day and do the same job each day for low wages. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
in response to a Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility recommendation to consider prosecution of CIA employees and contractors who are alleged to have tortured and abused U.S.-held detainees, Attorney General Eric Holder has appointed federal prosecutor John Durham to lead a new investigation. Durham is already investigating the destruction of CIA videotapes of harsh interrogations of American-held terrorist suspects after being appointed to that job in 2008 by President Bush's Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Holder's appointment of a prosecutor reverses a Bush administration decision not to investigate nearly a dozen cases of prisoner abuse. Under a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the ACLU, the Obama administration also released a 2004 CIA Inspector General report and memos detailing specific abuses of prisoners. Torture methods included mock executions, threats to kill prisoners' children, rape their mothers, and the use of guns and power drills to intimidate detainees. Documents disclose that one prisoner was beaten to death with a flashlight by a CIA contractor. Holder has stated the investigation will be limited to focusing on whether CIA and contracted interrogators violated Bush anti-torture guidelines. But human rights groups have called on Mr. Holder to broaden the investigation to include Bush administration attorneys and other officials who designed and implemented the torture policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with retired CIA officer Ray McGovern, who, during his 27-year career at the agency, briefed Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. McGovern assesses Attorney General Holder's decision to proceed with a narrow torture investigation conflicting with the mandate of international law for wider accountability.
There's one mischievous sort of canard running around. I was asked, that I had a TV interview with the BBC this afternoon. It goes like this: well, won't this damage the morale of agency operatives? Won't this make them more hesitant in the future to do these kinds of things? And they said, well, second question, yeah, but do you think that's not a good thing? I'd like them to be more hesitant, you know? I'd like them to reflect on the fact that there are U.S. laws as well as international laws against war crimes, because that's what torture is, a war crime.
Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to appoint a prosecutor to investigate nearly a dozen cases where CIA interrogators and contractors may have violated U.S. and international laws prohibiting torture and abuse of prisoners is said to be very narrow. And if you were to be advising Eric Holder or the President of the United States about where this investigation should go, how would you justify giving a prosecutor a wide range to do the right thing in all areas, including holding to account former Bush administration lawyers Jay Bybee and John Yoo, the guys who created some of these blatantly illegal guidelines for abusing and torturing prisoners?
From my point of view, if you don't investigate, and if the evidence is persuasive, if you don't prosecute those who were guilty of these very grievous war crimes, then they're going to happen again. Now, let me quote Walter Mondale, because he was asked this question again in late April. He said, holding people responsible in some way for what happened is very important. If the verdict here is that you can do these kinds of things and there are no consequences, then that leaves a precedent. And I've been around in Washington long enough to know what that means. Because there are lots of bad precedents. It's like leaving a loaded pistol on a kitchen table. You don't know who's going to pick it up and pull the trigger. There need to be consequences for violating the law. So that's the broad issue. And I think that even though this investigation is described as a very narrowly focused one on the CIA employees and contractors who went beyond guidance, the very flexible guidance of the Department of Justice, I think it's not going to be possible to hold it to that, and that by and large it's going to expand into the Department of Justice lawyers who authorize these torture techniques, including waterboarding. And if people have the courage, they will see. And please remember where you heard this first, if this is the first time you heard this. They will see that the President of the United States authorized torture by executive memo dated February 7, 2002. That was a two-page memo signed by George W. Bush in felt-tip pen with strokes an inch and a half long and wide. It's on the web. Look it up. Just put in George W. Bush torture, February 7, 2002. That's what George Bush said. We don't have to pay attention to the Geneva protections as far as Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees are concerned. Now, the Senate Armed Forces Committee did a thorough investigation of this. In December of last year, they said that memo of February 7, 2002, opened the door to all the abuses that followed.
Do you think that the appointment of John Durham, a federal prosecutor from Connecticut, to do the work of the prosecutor here on these torture cases will have in his scope President Bush and Vice President Cheney when it comes to who gave the ultimate orders here?
Well, he won't initially. Right now, his instructions are just to look at the folks that exceeded the Department of Justice guidelines. But those guidelines were so flexible. Now, those guidelines boil down to the fact that you could do anything you wanted to a detainee as long as you didn't cause either death or major organ failure. Okay? And so, telling a detainee that you're going to have his wife or his mother violated in front of you, or telling a detainee that you're going to kill his children, well, does that fit within the guidelines? Well, it's not expressly forbidden. It doesn't result in death. It doesn't result in major organ failure. So I can see a CIA guy saying, well, must be okay. Must be okay to bring an electric drill into the interrogation and turn it on and put it about an inch from a guy's head. That must be okay because I'm not causing death and I'm causing major organ failure. So it's going to be very, very messy, but I just hope that this fellow Durham, who's been over a year looking into the destruction of the CIA tapes of these interrogation sessions, I just hope that he's a principled lawyer, because that's what we need, a gutsy, independent lawyer with integrity and with a devotion to our Constitution, which, you know, used to be a very blessed thing and still is to a lot of the rest of us.
That was retired CIA officer Ray McGovern, co-founder of the group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Read McGovern's articles online at consortiumnews.com. In mid-August, President Obama announced that his administration won't attempt to achieve immigration reform this year, since he's focusing mostly on health care and climate change issues, leading up to an international conference on global warming in December. During the presidential campaign, Obama criticized the workplace sweeps by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in which hundreds of allegedly undocumented workers were arrested, with many being deported. He promised to target employers of illegal workers more than the workers themselves, and pledged to create a roadmap to citizenship for the estimated 12 million undocumented workers currently living in the U.S. But critics of the administration's actions say so far, just like in other areas such as the war against terrorism, secrecy, and bailouts for business interests, Obama has a lot in common with his predecessor, Mr. Bush. A study found that through the first 5 months of Obama's presidency, there has been no let-up in the increase in criminal prosecutions of undocumented immigrants by ICE enforcement agents. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mike Wishney, a law professor at Yale Law School who teaches the Workers and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic there. He has represented dozens of workers who have been arrested around the state of Connecticut in immigration raids. He says while some things have changed under Obama, others remain distressingly the same.
The Department of Homeland Security does not need congressional reform to dramatically alter many of the Bush administration practices that worked such misery on so many millions of families and communities around the country. And what has been frustrating and intensely disappointing, I think, is that the Obama administration has continued many of the Bush administration programs and practices. And it's no excuse to say, well, Congress hasn't acted, because we're not talking about those things that require statutory reform. We're talking about day-to-day enforcement and detention decisions, decisions within the tens of thousands of rotten cases that the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration, but which it continues to prosecute. In all of these areas, this administration has refused to alter or soften so many of the same Bush administration policies that they criticized and that President Obama criticized as a candidate. That's the real disappointment.
One thing that I thought had changed is that, you know, toward the end of Bush's two terms, there were a lot of major workplace raids where hundreds of undocumented workers were arrested, and that obviously the brunt of the enforcement power fell on the workers, not on the employers. And I thought that Obama was sort of shifting that. To your knowledge, has that happened? There haven't been any, at least that I've heard about, any big workplace raids since he took office. What about prosecuting employers?
There have been some changes from the past administration, some positive changes. One of those is the early statements by the new Obama administration leaders in the Department of Homeland Security that they would target employers rather than employees and shift away from many of the worksite raids they've been doing. There's a second example is a very recent announcement by John Morton, the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that the former quota system for the fugitive operations teams has been abolished. These quotas sent agents out looking to make their numbers each year, and I think was a contributing factor to some of the most aggressive enforcement. So there have been some changes. But on the whole, there's been far more continuity than change. And in fact, for most changes, there's been a reciprocal intensification somewhere else that I think on the whole, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe that total arrests and deportations are higher for the first 6 months of this year than they were in a comparable period under the Bush administration. Some of it has shifted. And so, for instance, there's a little less worksite enforcement or worksite raids. On the other hand, there's an intensification of involvement of state and local police in routine immigration enforcement. And so the administration has been very keen to expand 287G agreements, the Secure Communities Initiative, which is resulting, I think, in terrible consequences for local communities around the country. So, yes, pulling back in one area is unfortunately offset by intensification in another area, resulting in overall numbers being comparable.
Is that something that any local law enforcement agency, does it need approval of the federal government to do that?
Congress laid down a clear guidance in the statutes passed in 1996, and the statute requires that any state, local, or tribal, I believe, police agency that wishes to do civil immigration enforcement must execute a written agreement with the federal government. Its officers must be trained by federal immigration agents. Immigration law is complicated stuff. And they must be supervised, ultimately, by the federal immigration agents. And absent those things, written agreement, training, supervision, and so forth, they lack immigration enforcement powers.
Mike Wishney, due to the economic situation now, the number of people crossing the border from Mexico has diminished significantly because there are so many fewer jobs here. What impact do you think that might have on prioritizing immigration reform?
Times of economic distress have often fit with the rise of nativist and anti-immigrant movements in this country, where people have felt their job might be threatened by the presence of a foreign citizen. On the other hand, I think the labor movement is much more sophisticated today than it was 20 years ago about the reality of human migration, and that to resist some of those realities is ultimately counterproductive to the goal of protecting U.S. workers. What I mean concretely by that is you see today many of the largest labor unions saying it's important for the protection of U.S. workers that all workers be brought into the mainstream of the union movement and the mainstream of labor and employment law. And if we have a shadow population of millions of people who are out of status and afraid to stand up for their labor rights, that pulls us all down.
That was Mike Wishney of the Workers and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School. For more information, visit the clinic online at islandia.law.yale.edu/WIRC. As President Obama headed to Martha's Vineyard for a family vacation, the debate on reforming the nation's failed health care system rages on. A recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll found that 55% of those surveyed believed reform legislation would cover illegal immigrants, 50% believed proposed bills would pay for abortions, and 45% believed reform measures would authorize death panels to deny care to senior citizens. All of these claims are patently false. A Pew Research Center poll found that regular viewers of the Fox News channel are far more likely than viewers of other cable news channels to say claims of death panels are true. As the congressional August recess draws to a close, the public insurance option has emerged as a central focus of the health care reform debate, with the U.S. Senate likely playing a pivotal role in the legislative outcome. In recent days, Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona has rejected passage of a government-run health care plan, and independent Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut urged the postponement of such a plan until the economy improves. The White House projection that the national deficit will top $9 trillion within 10 years has prompted some to say we can't afford health care reform now. But Peter Orszag, President Obama's director of the Office of Management and Budget, insists the impact of rising Medicare costs on the deficit is precisely why we must enact fiscally well-designed health care reform now. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who urges President Obama to acknowledge there will be no bipartisan cooperation from Republicans on health care reform, switch tactics, and push for a single-payer plan or a strong public option.
The debate got ruined, if you will, and pulled dramatically off course by the failure of the Democrats to stand for the only practical alternative to the current health care system. If the crisis of health care is profiteering that puts the bottom line of insurance companies and healthcare corporations ahead of the lives of our children and our parents, ourselves, then the logical alternative is to remove the profit motive. The way to do that is not to set up a so-called competing public option. It's not to do consumer regulations. It is to establish a single-payer healthcare system designed to deliver care to all Americans at the most affordable cost with the greatest flexibility. This was the logical approach, and when the Democrats abandoned, at least at the leadership level, this approach to health care reform, they opened up a huge space. Now, this is not to condemn Obama or even the Democratic leaders in the House and Senate. It is simply to say that you cannot fight the combined power of the insurance industry and a Republican base that simply hates Barack Obama and hates Democrats being in power with a weak, very complicated, difficult to understand so-called reform. It's not something you can sell. And so what has happened is that the debate has been defined by those who say no. And those who would say yes to health care reform, by and large, have not showed up. You know, the reason the town hall meetings look so crazy is because the people who really fundamentally do want health care reform want single payer. And no, they're not inclined to go out and, you know, bang away and get all excited about a public option. And so I think the Democrats, by being so soft and by offering so little, have not given their base enough to fight for, and that has then tipped the debate toward those who are passionate, not logical, but passionate.
President Obama seems to be on the run here, losing credibility with activists on the left and right, and the debate now centering on the establishment of a public health insurance option to compete with large private health insurance companies. Obama has made indications that he wants to take that off the table, too, calling it recently just a sliver of his overall plan. Where is the White House going with this? It seems like these loudmouths at the town hall meetings have put him into full retreat.
Well, I don't know that it's put Obama into full retreat, but it has put a number of critical Democrats, the people he had to have to pass a plan, into retreat. And as a result, the president is then, you know, radically restructuring his approaches and doing so in an incredibly inept seemingly unconscious manner. Look, this is a disaster. Anybody who tells you differently is spinning and you know, trying to cling to some fantasy. The way that the Obama administration has handled this is every bit as inept and every bit as unwise as the way in which the Clinton administration handled health care reform back in the mid-90s. I don't have any problem with the president going out to Martha's Vineyard to take a week off. I think that's great. I think what he should do is sit down in front of a mirror and look at himself, look at his conscience, and ask what he wants to accomplish. He needs to rethink very rapidly and come back with something very, very bold. I would like him to do single payer. I understand that may be too much to ask, but if he doesn't do that, then he has to have the most robust public option imaginable. It must be a sufficient public option to be able to compete head-to-head at every turn with the insurance company's offerings. If he doesn't do that, if he doesn't at least do that, he will lose the health care fight. He will lose it because, A, he's got a united conservative opposition, but, B, because progressives will not go to the mat for something so uninspired and potentially even damaging. So, I mean, this is a critical moment, this next week or so. Barack Obama either muscles up and does the right thing, or he essentially becomes, you know, a somewhat more appealing Bill Clinton.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine and author of The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. Read Nichols' columns online at thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.